Okay, my guest on my last interview of 2018 for Podcasting Them Softly is a very, very super cool guest. I've waited a long time to have a chat with him this morning. I get to do it. He's the star. He's been in films like MASH, Black Caesar, Tough Guys, Adios Amigo, Mean Johnny Barrows, One Down, Two to Go, The Inglourious Basterds, not to be confused with Quentin Tarantino's Inglourious Basterds, 1990 Bronx Warriors, Warriors of the Wasteland, 3 Days to Kill, South Beach, No Way Back. He is the man, the legend, the hammer. He is Fred the Hammer Williamson. Hammer, thank you for being on Podcasting Them Softly.
Dude, what else would I be doing?
Oh, man, I don't know. I suppose if you were down under, yeah, we'd be sitting having a cigar together or something.
I'm having a cigar on the patio right now because it's raining, so I love the smoke on the patio when it's raining, man. It, like, takes me back to good old mellow days, man, back in Chicago and relaxing. And when I'm in Rome, when it's raining, I love rain, man. I'm a Midwesterner. I just love the sound of the rain. It's very calming.
Oh, yeah. I suppose we'd have to have a cigar somewhere where it is raining, because in Australia we don't get too much rain.
I live in Palm Springs. We don't get too much rain here. That's why I'm so excited. It rained maybe once every 2 years here, man, so I'm excited by seeing the rain.
Yeah.
So that's why I'm excited. Palm Springs is a desert. We get no rain here.
Wow. Yeah, Australia's a bit the same. I'm glad I'm sitting down, Hammer, because this is a real honor for me, man. I love all of your movies.
You didn't mention From Dusk Till Dawn, dude. That's the latest. That's it. Everybody seems to be getting a kick out of that sucker.
Yeah. I love that too. But I mean, I love all of the pictures where you were, you know.
Well, you can't get them all. You can't get them all, man. There's like 60, 65 of them. You can't get them all.
I know. So I figured maybe just to kick off, I know that there's always people who listen to the show that aren't as cinema savvy as others. So I was wondering if you might just very briefly, to start off, just give people a little bit of a history of how you came. You know, a lot of people know that you played football before you were an actor.
Right.
If you could give people a little bit of a backstory of how you came to the film business.
Well, first of all, I'm a college graduate from Northwestern University with an architecture and engineering degree. So being in the movie business was far-fetched from my mentality. Also, playing pro football was not something that I had saw in my future. But at Northwestern, I was good at it, so I was fortunate enough to take it off into the pros. And it gave me an inroad because I created an image. And my image, I'm very lucky that my image that I have on the screen is close to my image in real life. And what I portrayed on the football field as a badass. And a lot of movies that I make are like Eastwood, Bronson combination, would always have a badge. So when they book me, like in Black Cobra, I'm a badass with a badge. So I have an image that works for me, and I'm lucky that the fans see it the same way. And that sort of helps, keeps me working, keeps me going. Being in the movie business is something that happened once I stopped playing football and went full-time as an architect. I could not make the transition comfortably. Sitting behind a desk doing 9 to 5 and an hour for lunch just did not fit my personality. So one night I'm looking at television and I see Diane Carroll, first black actress to have her own television series. It was called Julia. And I noticed that the guest star role each week was a new boyfriend. And I said, well, man, I'm better looking than those guys. I'm going to Hollywood and become Diane Carroll's boyfriend on the Julia show. Well, it took me 3 days to accomplish that. They signed me to a 3-year contract to play her boyfriend on the Julia show.
All right.
Fortunately, it was at 20th Century Fox. I was sitting in the commissary one day, and a guy walks by, and he says, you're the Hammer, right? I said, yeah, I'm the Hammer. He says, I'm doing a movie. I got a football scene in it. I don't know anything about football. Would you direct or cast all the football players so I could have a legitimate football game in the movie? I said, yeah, no problem. The guy was Robert Altman, and the movie was MASH.
Fantastic.
My first movie.
Fantastic. What a beginning.
Yeah, you know, you got to have a beginning of something. You know, I mean, when you go for something, the worst thing somebody can say to you is no.
Yeah.
But no is a good thing, because no gives you an opportunity to go back and correct your faults and come back again. And every time they say no, you get better and better. So pretty soon that no gets tossed out of the window, yes will eventually take its place.
Yeah. No, it's there's so many incredible stories about how people come into the film business. Some, you know, it's like that old saying, isn't it? Like, some are born to greatness, some achieve greatness, and some have greatness thrust upon them, don't you think?
Yeah, it was a combination of all of that would be perfect, but being thrust upon you doesn't work in Hollywood. You have to bring something to the table that has some financial value. And don't think it's all about you love them and they love you. It's not about that. The moment you stop making them money, you no longer exist. So I didn't want to wait for that to happen. That's why I started making my own, producing my own. I learned the business of the business while I was working. I absorbed everything around me. I watched what they did. I bugged the crew. What do you call that thing? Why are you putting that over there? What is that over there? I bugged them. By the time I got ready to do my own, I was qualified technically to make a film. So then I had to learn the business of the business. So the first thing I did was I went to Cannes. I went to Cannes, France. I sit on the patio of the Carlton Terrace because I heard that's where all the big high rollers hang out. I gave the maitre d' $50 a day to save me a table in the middle of the patio at the Carlton Terrace. And I just sit and I watch and I learn how to deal.
Yeah. Because that's, I mean, really at the end of the day, after all the filmmaking is done, it's all about selling it, isn't it?
It's all about selling, but then you got to know who you're making the movie for. Making a movie is maybe simple to some people, but you better know who your market is. You better know that guy on the corner. When you pass by him, ask him, I'm getting ready to make a movie, and this is going to happen. Would you go see it? If he says, what? You're going to do what? What kind of movie? Forget about it. Change your movie. Do something different or cast it different. You got to talk to the people on the street because that's who you're making it for.
Yeah, exactly. They're your audience, and the people are going to line up and buy movie tickets, or as is commonly...
But unless it's a Hollywood.
Yeah.
Unless it's a Hollywood film, right? They make it for $90 million, then they spend $10 million with TV ads, making a lot of noise on television. Yeah. They make you run to the TV when you hear all this noise. You run to the TV and see what it is. But you suddenly realize after a few years, that's the heart of the movie. That noise that you hear for 10 seconds is a damn movie.
Yeah, and then of course it's on bus sides and billboards and everywhere else. They spend so much money on
it. The mentality of an independent filmmaker has to be much more different than the Hollywood guys, because we don't have the money to have the special effects, because today special effects is the star of the movie.
Yeah.
You have to have a story that people are interested in, keep their interest. Special effects, you don't have the money, you better have a good story.
Yeah. I like the story you told once, that when you made one of your first independent pictures, No Way Back, and you went to the Cannes Film Festival and you put little girls in tight t-shirts long before it was popular, and you sold the heck out of No Way Back.
After I learned how to get the financing, I sold the film with just a poster. Because I didn't have the money to make the film, so I sold it with a poster. Mm. And I did it by doing the t-shirts with the girls. I took the contracts from the foreign buyers back to the bank here in America. They loaned me money against the contracts. I made the movie, and I delivered the movie to the buyers. That's the way I first started making my movies.
Yeah, totally. So, Hammer, I wonder if we might just take a little trip down memory lane before we talk about the latest and greatest film that we're talking up today, which is Nazi Doomsday Device, also known as Atomic Eden. I just handpicked a couple. These are some of my absolute personal favorites of yours. And if you could maybe tell us a little bit, if you have some reminiscences or something like that. The first one I love. I absolutely think this is a great film, and it also puts you alongside some of the other legends, like Jim Brown and Richard Roundtree
Kelly.
Yeah.
Jim Kelly.
Jim Kelly, yeah. And it's called One Down and Two to Go. Right. Man, I love that movie. It's just like it's like the ultimate cast. There's, you know, you, Jim Brown, and Richard, and Jim, and it's just, wow. I mean, what a lineup, right? It's almost like in modern times where you have, like, the big, like, George Clooney and Brad Pitt and all that sort of stuff, but it was you guys all together in this movie. What was that like?
Well, it was actually a sequel. It was actually a sequel to Three the Hard Way to put us back together again. It's just the majors didn't seize the idea. They didn't see it as a profitable thing to do, so I seized it upon myself to bring a sequel to Three the Hard Way, which is One Down, Two to Go.
Yeah.
Now, these guys are my friends, personally.
Yeah.
So it was easy for me to write their character as I know them.
Yeah.
I know Jim Kelly is a martial arts. Roundtree is a cool-looking guy that shoots a gun. Jim has this facade of being an angry young man who can kill you with a look. And I'm the dandy Don. I'm the smooth, sweet-talking one to make this combination work, because we all can't be tough guys.
Right.
Somebody has to be different. Personalities have to be different to make it work. Everybody can't be heroes. So I didn't write it for them to be heroes. Each guy got caught in his own situation. Each guy had to defend himself the way he thought was best to do it. And that's what made the movie work.
Yeah. It's awesome. Awesome stuff. Another one that I'm very partial to. A lot of people are well aware that early on, we Australians haven't been too influential worldwide, or, you know, back during this film's release anyway, weren't too influential, but we did make one film that broke through and became such an influence through Europe and America. It was a film called The Road Warrior. And in the wake of The Road Warrior, there were all kinds of spoofs and rip-offs. One of them was Warriors of the Wasteland, which was an Italian production, which you're in. Can you tell me, man, that's a wild, like, yeah, man, I mean, it takes The Road Warrior to a whole new level. What was it like making Warriors of the Wasteland?
But that's an Italian philosophy. Italian, they like to copy things and put their Italian touch on it.
Yeah.
And that's really kind of what they did, because they don't have the money really to have all those machines and all those cars and all those things that that they had in Road Warrior.
Yeah.
But they try to give you characters like Road Warrior did.
Yeah.
So I played this character who fits my image. I sell a brand. Yeah. I don't just come into a movie as an actor. I sell a brand. Like, you can't kill me in a movie.
Yeah.
I have to win all my fights in a movie.
Yeah.
And I get the girl at the end of the movie. Now, these are the things I demand, but I give in to one of them because I know they're not going to do all three.
Right.
And the one that I know they're not going to give me is guaranteed that I can have the girl at the end of the movie. But I know damn well I can guarantee they can't kill me and I have to win my fights.
Yeah.
So as long as I keep that standard and that image, I'm not surprising my fans. They know when they see me in a movie, they know what they're going to get. I don't sing. I don't dance. It's not that I can't. I may do it in private. I may do it at a party, but I'm not doing it on the screen.
Right.
So I sell an image and I don't deviate from it. And this film fit my image perfectly.
That's great. That's great. I've seen it since. It's been restored. There's been a different transfer made of it recently, and because for the longest time it was just this very, very gauzy sort of old VHS, but they recently did a bit of must have had a transfer from a master tape or something on it, and it's really something to see. It is completely bizarre. It is completely wild, but it was wonderful, you know, of course, being a fan of yourself, to see you in that kind of movie. I guess the other one, I actually watched this last night in preparation for our little chat, was The Inglourious Basterds, not to be confused with...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, not to be confused with Quentin Tarantino's Inglorious Bastards.
Well, that movie was a fun movie. Quentin was a more violent movie. That movie was a fun, pleasant action kind of film.
Yeah.
Quentin was after the blood, the guts, and the glory. Luckily, the Italians didn't go for that in their Inglorious Bastards. Yeah. It was a story about three guys who are trying to get away from the war, trying to get out, and all of a sudden they discovered they can do something to help the war by destroying this train that had a bomb. That's why it's called Inglorious Bastards, because on the way from escaping from the war, we decided to change and do something positive for the war, so we became Inglorious Bastards.
What was an actor I always admired? What was Bo Svenson like to work with?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to kill. It's hard to kill assholes. His career may be dead, but unfortunately he's still around.
Oh, really? Okay, fair enough. Enough said. Anyway, let's talk about the movie in question. It's a wonderful action picture, which you're headlining. From Nico Sentner, it is known as Atomic Eden, but it's also being dubbed Nazi Doomsday Device. Hammer, how did you come to be involved with the movie?
Well, I try to help independent young directors or producers, help them out, get into their business, and he brought this project to me. And I said, okay, I'll help you do it. You know, you don't have to pay me any money to do this. I'll help you because the character you want me to play is definitely not destructive to my image. As long as the film adheres to my image, my what I'm selling, then I can help you because, you know, I have a philosophy in all the work that I do, not just in this one, which is I may be in a bad movie, but I would never be bad in a bad movie.
Right.
So I didn't know where he was going with the project, but fortunately it turned out to be a fairly decent project. It turned out to be pretty good. It turned out to be interesting. Didn't have the special effects, but you'll never know that based on all the people that we shot up and all the fighting and shooting that we did, blowing up a building. I mean, all that stuff was available to him. I think that's where he got the idea. He had this building that he could blow up and that we could shoot in, and so he decided to make this kind of movie. And so that was very interesting to me to be involved in this kind of project. And I love working in Europe anyway. I mean, I love working there probably more in the U.S. I have more fun working out of the country than I do in America.
Right. And, I mean, again, I mean, it's good, solid territory for you, because it's like Inglourious Basterds. It's men on a mission.
Yeah.
Right? You know?
Yeah.
It's men on a mission.
Yep.
And it's a mission to, you know, you're there trying to survive, but you're also still trying to, you know, you're still trying to accomplish.
And the good thing about it, all the people that were involved didn't know what the mission was.
Right.
I was the only one who knew what the mission was.
Yeah.
And then when the mission started to, you know, get dangerous and the bad guys started to close in on us, I had to reveal what the mission was.
Yeah. I actually had a chat with Nico yesterday, and he said you had some interesting stories. He said one involves him. He says tell Fred. Nico says, I hear traffic. Home is this way.
Well, you see, that's what makes it work fun in Europe, because they assume that American actors are more polished because
Right.
we've had more experience and more exposure to things. And so they always like to look at us as a learning process, you know. So every foreign actor wants to be in a movie in America so they can have worldwide popularity, which is understandable.
Yeah.
So they watch me and when I'm in a character, I'm into the character totally. So we did this big explosion scene and fighting scene, and we're walking through a field as everything is over. And finally we stop to say something. Are you okay? Everybody's all right? Yeah. Then we hear some trucks and some horns blowing. And that was nowhere in the script, was nowhere in the story. And I immediately said, I hear traffic. Home is that way. So we started walking toward where we heard the traffic. I mean, that's just being improvised and being totally into the character and understanding that you have to do something, you know, to wipe out this background. It's not in the script and it's not in the story, so you better make it happen. Let it happen.
His other one was, ask him how it was to shoot in a real bunker.
To do what? In a real bunker?
In a real bunker.
In a real bunker?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, this weapon is in a suitcase type thing, and it has lights in it. When you open it up, it lights up, which means you better close it up real quick.
Yeah.
But he didn't hide it very well. It was like a spur to moment. Where do I put this thing, right? So when we shot the scene, he took us in this little cave. That was pretty nice. It was a Hitler bunker, and everybody's tearing things down and pulling things out. And I decide to go sit in a chair. And as I'm sitting in the chair, I look over to my right, and behind this desk was the suitcase. And I picked it up, and I looked at it, and behold, it was the Atomic Eden weapon.
Right.
I mean, I had to play it like, wow, here it is, man. We discovered this thing, right? But it was so much in the open that I had to play it and make it like I had discovered this thing by accident.
Yeah, that's great. I was recently watching the documentary they made about Larry Cohen, King Cohen, which you feature in, and you, you know, you of course were, you know, in his film Black Caesar, and they also made the sequel. What was it? Hell Down in Harlem, or was the sequel to that?
Hell Up in Harlem.
Sorry, yeah. But what struck me as interesting, and still does today, like they talk about films, the diversity in cinema today, and how movies like Black Panther are a big deal because it's, you know, starring, written and directed, and everything by, you know, people of color. And I was thinking about when you came up, you know, through the business, and they had what, you know, they asked Larry the same question, you know, what do you think of blaxploitation? And he says, I don't know what blaxploitation means. He said, exploitation. He said,
he got that from me.
Yeah. He said,
he got that from me. I don't understand what it means anyway.
Yeah. And he said, you know, all films are exploitation. But, you know,
let me explain this to you, that black exploitation means nothing to me, and I explain it to him, but it means nothing because who is being exploited?
Yeah.
The actors are now making more money than they were before.
Yeah.
They're now winning some of the fights. The black guy doesn't always die in the movie.
Yeah.
The audience are being very satisfied because now they have an opportunity to have some black heroes or some black strong male images. So the audience is in love with these characters. So exploitation word was used by the media that was white, that was trying to destroy what was going on.
Right,
simple reason, it's a business thing.
Yeah.
It's a business thing. I play a film, we play Black Caesar in New York on 85th Street, say, and our movie costs less than $1 million. We got lines around the theater three times.
Yeah.
Across the street is a $90 million movie made by a major, and there's nobody there.
Right.
It's not full. There's nobody there. So we became competition to the majors. So what happened? It became much more difficult to find money to fund the kind of films that we wanted to make.
Right.
So that, it only lasted 4 years.
Yeah.
The so-called black exploitation thing.
Yeah.
Only lasted 4 years.
Yeah. No, I've always been intrigued. I mean, because when they look back now, like even in it, when our industry, when we had a big sort of grindhouse genre filmmaking industry back in the 70s and early 80s, they look back now and call it Ozploitation. You know, I've always just wanted to ask you, like, you know, I know that period was very brief. How do you see it today as opposed to then, you know, with movies like, you know, Spike Lee's films and Black Panther and all that sort of, those movies.
Well,
I mean, they're remaking Superfly as well and stuff like that, you know. How do you see it today?
Variety Variety did a back page ad with me on the cover in March, end of March.
Right.
And it had a full picture of me sitting smoking a cigar.
Right.
That they pulled out of the files.
Yeah.
And under the picture it said, Fred Williamson is not a black actor. Fred Williamson is an actor.
Yeah.
Before Black Panther, there was The Hammer.
Right.
Variety did this on their own. That page would have cost me $7,500.
Right.
But they see what's going on. What's going on is they're becoming more business-oriented because they are now realizing all these years they have missed a market totally. And that market has been the black audience.
Yeah.
Black audiences don't, you can't sell them Tom Cruise. There's nothing that a black guy can relate to Tom Cruise with, you know?
You're right.
So they now, understanding that they have to make films, if they want to some extra money on top of the money that they are going to get, if they want to put some icing on the cake, then you give them something or someone in the movie that the black audiences can relate to, and then they come and they see it. If it's all Tom Cruise and it's all the other so-called white superstars, they're not interested. They don't want to see that.
Yeah.
They'll watch it on TV, but they don't want to plop their money down to see that. They want to see somebody else. Unfortunately, Hollywood only sees three black actors because
right.
they have no black friends. They don't communicate with the black people in public. They ride in limousines. They don't ride in streetcars. They don't ride on buses, so they have no black friends.
Right.
So when they read a script, and on page six it says, a black man walks in the door, it's Samuel Jackson.
Right.
Black man walks out of the door, it's Denzel Washington.
Right.
Or somebody else running down the street, it's Will Smith. So
right.
that's their mentality. Their mentality is limited about all the other actors that are available for the counterparts, because Samuel Jackson is in every goddamn movie.
Right.
I mean, he's a good actor,
yeah.
but he ain't great for all the parts that he played. There's a lot of parts that he's in. It's miscast. It
right.
doesn't fit. But they're limited to their knowledge of what's available, because
right.
that's all they know.
Yeah.
Three of them, like, you know, Samuel, Denzel, Will Smith.
Yeah.
The kid who did Black Panther,
yeah.
I bet you in 2 years, you won't even remember his name.
Right.
Because he didn't make the picture. He didn't make the picture. The special effects made him make the picture.
Right, yeah, yeah. Mm. No, I totally agree with you. There's this, with those kinds of films, there's a very, very much a biodegradable quality they're like bottled rockets, you know, they fly very high, explode brilliantly, and then vanish on the wind.
It's like a Marvel, man.
Yeah.
You know, you can't keep selling that character all the time. Sooner or later, it's got to be a normal human being.
Yeah.
And once he starts becoming a normal human being, nobody's going to remember his name. Nobody's going to remember what he did, and nobody's going to care.
Yeah. I mean, and you yourself know from, you know, being a writer, director, producer, actor, all of the hats that you wear, if the hero of the story, if you don't root for him, if you don't care about him, then you're out of the story, right? You're not going to care if he wins or loses.
Well, first you have to decide, what is a He-Man? What does that really mean?
Right.
A He-Man to me means a guy who gets caught in a situation and has to think his way out of it first, and he has a lot of adversities. If he goes this way, that's the wrong way. If he goes that way, it's the wrong way. But he finds a way to win the situation and get himself out of the situation. That is a He-Man.
Right.
Not the guy who can fly and who's bulletproof, who has good muscles that he can hardly, you know, keep his arms from touching each other when he walks.
Right.
That is a different kind of He-Man, you know. A He-Man is a guy who handles a real situation and overcomes it and deals with it and wins it. That's a He-Man.
Yeah. Couldn't have said it better, Hammer. Couldn't have said it better. Of course I can't say it better because I'm not the Hammer. But you're the Hammer. And Hammer, it has been... It has been a lifelong dream fulfilled for me today to talk to one of my heroes, Fred the Hammer Williamson, about
Appreciate it.
About a wonderful film that that is currently streaming VOD in the UK and some other territories. It is Nazi Doomsday Device, also known as Atomic Eden. It stars Fred the Hammer Williamson, directed by Nico Centner. It's a wonderful movie. And, of course, if you haven't heard of Fred the Hammer...
It's an entertaining. It's an entertaining movie. It's made for entertainment. Sit there with your popcorn and a Coca-Cola or a brew or a beer.
Yeah.
And enjoy it.
Have a great time. And, of course, if you haven't heard of Fred the Hammer Williamson, you've probably been living with your head stuck in the ground for a long time. He's a man. He's the legend. It's been absolutely fantastic. Fred, I have one more humble request before we sign off. I was wondering, you mentioned From Dusk Till Dawn earlier. I wonder if you could sign off by doing the line From Dusk Till Dawn. Yo, monkey man, anything you want to say to them, say to me first.
No problemo.
Okay.
Yo, monkey man, anything you got to say to him, say to me first.
That's fantastic. Thank you, Hammer. It has been a real... You've got no idea what sort of pleasure. Absolutely astronomical. Thank you for being on podcast.
I had fun. Thank you.
Thank you for being on Podcast Them Softly. Have a wonderful day, my friend.
Thank you. Ciao.